Hello, we the people. This is Carmela Ciliberti. Thank you for joining me.
Prepare yourself for a shock. The political parties are litigating who has control of the Pennsylvania House. I'm going to walk through this issue because it demonstrates how completely childish, petty, and two-faced some of these so-called leaders are. As we go through this, keep one question in mind. Do you want these people to have more or less power over your life? Between November 30th, the end of the last legislative session, and the next legislative session, which begins January 3rd, there is no Speaker of the Pennsylvania House. The business of the House is conducted by the Majority Leader. The Majority Leader is determined by which party holds, wait for it, the majority seats in the House. As we mentioned previously, the result of November's election was a tie, 101 to 101. This tie occurred due to the death of a representative. Therefore, there was no majority leader. If you recall, two more seats were in question because those individuals won both their election for House representative and new offices of Lieutenant Governor and U.S. Congress. Those two seats counted toward the Democrat total because they had not yet officially resigned. On the last day of the legislative session, again, November 30th, Brian Cutler, then Speaker of the State House, put forth the paperwork to hold a special election for the vacant seat as soon as legally possible, February 7th. A week later, on December 7th, the tie in the House was broken as the two representatives filed their resignations. The House was then 101 Republican to 99 Democrat. On this very same day, Joanna McClinton, House Leader for the Democrats, had herself sworn in as Majority Leader of the State House in an unpublicized ceremony. McClinton then filed paperwork to hold the special elections on February 7th. Could she be any more of a child?
No, I want to file the writ, and I want to be the first woman of color to do so in Pennsylvania's legislative history.
Ugh. This is all, according to McClinton, to respect the will of the voters of Pennsylvania. What a peach she is. Now, what is she going to do on January 3rd, when a new Speaker of the House will be elected? Again, the House is split 101 Republican to 99 Democrat, and only a simple majority is needed to elect a new Speaker. What kind of nonsense will Ms. McClinton and her colleagues pull in an effort to gain power? This is why I support Brian Cutler and the Republican Party litigating the issue. In a press conference, Cutler explains,
in terms of the lawsuit, the question is actually very simple. It's who has the power to issue the writs, and it's not somebody who is not in a numerical majority. That's really the only question that will be before the court. It's a question of math. I think most folks understand it. I think in terms of their positioning in terms of when they wanted to have the laws, the elections, was really a rush to get to 102 as quickly as possible. That's really not the framework that our Constitution is built under. When you look at the Brazell case, it's very clear the majority leader can issue writs. And at 101-101, there was no majority. And at 101-99, we are the majority. And those writs could only be issued once the seats were vacated. Those letters had been received. They were timestamped. They were dated. Those members are no longer eligible to be seated. And because of that, that means that the majority leader has to issue the writs. And that's really the only question that we're asking the court to address. In terms of timing, we will get to that, in terms of setting it. Unfortunately, I think that the actions that were taken last week will actually further delay an opportunity because, remember, it's 60 days or no later than the next scheduled election. 60 days was the limit that was picked. You've got mail-in ballots, you've got absentee ballots, you've got a system that is in place that will make it very difficult to administer when there's uncertainty injected into it. And unfortunately, their actions last week injected an insurmountable amount of uncertainty in the electoral process. The problem is when you come to the floor of the House and you engage in activity in secret and you don't inform other members of what you're intending to do, that creates a relationship that lacks trust, and it creates a problem going forward. So that is the only reason that any of those conversations are currently being questioned.
Like I said, I support the Republican effort to hold the line on this issue. However, isn't it interesting that these boobs all of a sudden care about the rules? Care about the Pennsylvania Constitution? all while ripping it to shreds with their vote for Act 77? Are you sick of hearing about Act 77? Sorry, not sorry. We have only just begun to feel the pain of that act. That gift is the gift that will keep on giving. Our Commonwealth and country will bear the consequences for decades, even after Act 77 is hopefully overturned. Again, I ask you, do you want these people to have more or less power over your life? Will the Republicans ever stop compromising with individuals of the Democrat Party who insist on behaving like children? As the Shapiro administration ramps up, abuses its executive power, and circumvents the legislature, will Republicans stand together and say no? Will they use the power of the purse to shut down tyranny? No, you may not disregard the Constitution. No, you may not increase the state budget. No, you may not increase taxes. No, you may not compel allegiance to your worldview. No, you may not accumulate power to yourself. Sadly, only a few, we know, will hold the line. Now, on to why Republicans are in this position to begin with. Some of you may not want to hear this, but we must not take the easy way out and scream voter fraud, pack up our toys, and leave the playground. Certainly, there were fraudulent as well as illegal votes counted. It occurs in every election. Whether it rose to the level of changing the outcomes of a race is another thing entirely. Until such time as there is evidence, I will not be attributing Democrat wins to these causes. Citizen groups across the Commonwealth are looking closely at election integrity. I applaud, support, and encourage their efforts. In the meantime, we must get our heads around the losses, dust ourselves off, grow from the experience, and get back in the ring. After voter fraud, the second most popular explanation for Republican losses is to attribute those losses to the quality of the candidates. Look, may I just dismiss this one? Fetterman won. So please, don't come to me with the candidate quality argument unless you can show me a Democrat candidate with a better resume than the Republican. It is possible this occurred in a couple of the 228 combined state representative and state Senate races. However, if the gubernatorial and U.S. Senate races are any indication, any sane person looking to hire a burger flipper would have picked the Republican candidates over the Democrats. Their resumes were simply stronger. Also, please don't argue that the state GOP failed by not endorsing candidates in the primary. My suspicion is that none of the Republicans in the primary would have won in the general election. Once the voter data is updated, we'll be able to determine if the Democrats even needed independents or crossover Republicans to win. Is it possible they overwhelmed both voting contingents by sheer volume of mail-in ballots? Is it possible the Democrat Party simply outworked the Republicans? In his Real Clear Pennsylvania article, Ethan Kuturumbas explains, Delaware County's Democratic candidates relentlessly knocked on doors throughout the summer, carrying mail-in ballot applications for voters. The candidates' volunteers and paid canvassers did the same, knowing that 85% of those who apply will cast a ballot. Those votes were in the bank before Labor Day. The third most popular explanation for Republican losses is that conservative policies are no longer in vogue. We know that policies which align with the principles and rights outlined in our Constitution are virtuous and true. Any candidate putting forward the freedom agenda has the winning argument as they are standing in the truth. So why didn't they win? Early boomers were the last generation taught that there is truth and that it can be known. While progressives infiltrated our education system in the 20s, they really didn't start to gain traction until the 60s. Every generation since has been progressively indoctrinated and purposefully confused to the point that they no longer know what is in their best interest. But this group is still only a fraction of the whole voting population. So again, why didn't freedom-oriented candidates win? I suspect it is because of the mail-in ballot. Again, Act 77, the gift that keeps on giving. The Democrats didn't bother to debate. They knew they didn't need to argue for their policies. They knew they would overwhelm both independents and Republicans. Can we pause here and reflect on just how perverse our politics are in Pennsylvania? Our majority Republican state legislature, along with the Pennsylvania Republican Party lawyers, before COVID was even a thing, ran roughshod over the Pennsylvania Constitution and foisted mail-in ballots upon us. And these same degenerates tell their voters not to vote by mail. How asinine is that? I ask you, what is more likely? A, that all of these people are that stupid, or B, that a good portion of these people are working to accumulate and hold on to power? I'm going with C, both. Now, you may be thinking, we are never going to win again until we get rid of mail-in ballots, and we can't get rid of mail-in ballots until we win again, so I'm relocating out of the state. Hey, I totally understand this mentality, and if I didn't love where I live so much, I would be right there with you. But there is another way, and I can even give you an example. Florida. Of those who voted in mail in Florida, 33% were registered Republicans, 42% were Democrats, and 25% were other. Contrast this with Pennsylvania. While the data isn't in yet for those who actually submitted their mail-in ballots by party, we do know the breakdown of those who requested mail-in ballots. Again, Florida, of those who voted by mail, 33% were registered Republicans, 42% Democrat, 25% other. In Pennsylvania, of requested mail-in ballots, 20% were registered Republicans, 54% were Democrats, and 25% were other. Is it any wonder why Republican candidates lost? They are not taking advantage of the opportunities offered by mail-in voting. Again, Pennsylvania GOP is not taking advantage of the very system they pushed for. These people are as bright as a burnout light bulb. Do you think that if Republicans pushed mail-in voting, their total number of voters would increase? Of course it would. A voter's opportunity to cast their ballot would extend from one day to 20 plus days. Now, understand, I loathe mail-in voting. As soon as we had the ability to do so, PA should do away with it, returning to single-day, in-person voting with voter ID. That way, we can all be disenfranchised equally. In the meantime, why are we disenfranchising ourselves by not utilizing any and all lawful methods to get out the vote? Finally, Republican leadership is at least paying lip service to the idea that the party needs to utilize every legal means to get out the vote, to include the mail-in ballot. According to a December 2nd Politico article, Pennsylvania Republican leadership is reconsidering their war on mail-in voting. GOP officials in the state are coming to the belief that it's better to work within the system than politically die by it. No kidding. Republican and conservative activists need to embrace mail-in voting as it isn't going away anytime soon, wrote GOP State Rep. Russ Diamond in a postmortem on his website. Our goal isn't to convince regular voters to vote by mail, but to figure out how to cultivate mail-in votes from those registered Republicans who vote infrequently or don't vote at all. Republican National Committee man in Pennsylvania, Andy Riley, stated, "There's no question in my mind that Republicans have to have a different mail-in strategy. When one party votes for 30 days and one party votes for one, you're definitely going to lose." Lawrence Tabus, chair of Pennsylvania's Republican Party, states, "I intend to work on encouraging and getting out our voters to vote by mail. I mean, 650,000 some ballots were cast this year before the U.S. Senate debate even occurred. You have 50 days to vote by mail. If you vote at the polls, it's 13 hours. We've outvoted the Democrats at the polls, but the mail is something that we need to work on." The Political article closes with a quote from Charlie Garreau, the Pennsylvania-based vice chair of the Conservative Political Action Coalition. He likened the GOP's approach to mail-in voting to a basketball player who abstains from shooting from behind the three-point line because he doesn't like the rule. "You could play a game that way, and more times than not, you would lose," he said. "Or you can say, hey, I don't like the three-point line, but by gosh, I'm going to be the best three-point shooter you can find. And that's what I think the Republicans have to be now." Well, no kidding. Some of us have been saying this from day one. The antics of man is so frustrating. We are in such a mess. I don't know about you, but I need some perspective. So let's push the throttle forward, pull back on the yoke, and climb up out of this. In times when people seem to have gone completely bonkers, I find it comforting to look back at human history. Whether you are a believer or not, the Bible is one of the oldest texts documenting the human condition. If we reflect on the Old Testament, we see that humans have been making decisions against their own self-interest for thousands of years. Moses and the Israelites come to mind. As you recall, Moses led the Israelites out of Egypt to free them from their oppressors. However, God did not march them out of Egypt immediately, nor did he take them on a direct route to the Promised Land. It took roughly 50 days from Moses' first request to let his people go until they finally left Egypt. Once out of Egypt, what could have been a few short weeks' march to the Promised Land took 40 years. Think of that, 40 years. Why? Because not only did God want the Egyptians to witness his power, but the Israelites also needed to grow into the people capable of residing in the Promised Land. They not only needed to be liberated from an oppressive ruler, but also from their own oppressive, sinful nature. Does any of this sound familiar? Can any parallels be drawn between the behavior of the Egyptian pharaoh and the oppressors today, or the sinful Israelites and freedom-loving sinful Americans today? Note that I don't draw the distinction between Democrats and Republicans because the GOP is not always freedom-oriented and they are corrupt as well. The Israelites were once politically connected and favored in Egypt, but a new pharaoh, as well as his successor, saw them as a threat to their power. They wanted to make sure the size of Israel was manageable, small enough to keep from toppling their rulers, but large enough and productive enough to keep the pharaohs in largesse. Pharaoh implemented infanticide to accomplish this end. Can any parallels be drawn between late-term abortion and infanticide, if not a way to control the American population? The pharaohs isolated and oppressed the Israelites to the point that Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. This is the same tactic used today. Freedom-oriented Americans are categorized as a threat, think MAGA, and government force, think 87,000 new IRS agents, are employed to confiscate their labor. There are so many lessons we can learn from the story of Moses, but in keeping with tradition, I will only list 10. 1. God wants us to be free. God wants to deliver his people from bondage, both from the bondage of our own sinful nature and the bondage of another man's oppression. 2. We must pray for deliverance. Even though the Israelites had not yet come to know their Creator, they cried out in prayer for deliverance. 3. Understanding one's opponent is critical to success. Moses was the adopted grandson of Pharaoh, spending his early childhood with his people and the latter part in the Egyptian court. Moses had an insider's view of the enemy. Therefore, he understood both worldviews and was wise to Egyptian tactics. 4. Our leaders will be flawed. Look, we all know that none of us are perfect. However, this becomes more evident and more difficult to accept from those who serve in leadership roles. Moses was flawed, and yet God used him mightily. What were some of the traits Moses embodied that allowed God to use him in spite of those flaws? Well, Moses admitted to God that he was not up to the task, and he was humble enough to accept help when God provided it through his brother Aaron. Moses acknowledged his sin, repented, and accepted the consequences of his actions. Moses was a principled man, holding individuals accountable for their actions, whether they were from his own tribe, an Egyptian, or a shepherd. He relied on God and continually reminded his people to place their hope in the Lord. 5. We must petition our government in an orderly fashion. God is just and loves order. He did not simply liberate his people. Even though it would take several acts of God for Pharaoh to let the Israelites go, God sent Moses and the elders to petition Pharaoh for their freedom. Their petition was clear, concise, and based on God's truth. 6. We must employ creative civil disobedience. Pharaoh ordered Israeli midwives to murder the male babies when Jewish women were on the birthing stool. The midwives did not follow the order and were creative when challenged by Pharaoh, stating that Israeli women gave birth before the midwives arrived. Don't you love how they worked around the order? They didn't admit to being disobedient. They didn't throw anyone under the bus. They used Pharaoh's own order against him, exploiting a technicality. 7. We must protect children from tyranny. In addition to the midwives failing to murder baby boys, Pharaoh's own daughter disobeyed his order and adopted Moses. These women protected the future, the children. 8. Petitioning the government for freedom and acts of civil disobedience will lead to greater oppression. Life for the Israelites got worse before it got better. Pharaoh's initial response was to double down on his oppression, ordering his slave drivers to work the Israelites harder. The Israelites began to make excuses for the Egyptians' behavior in a misguided attempt to minimize their oppression. Rather than holding the Egyptians accountable for their behavior, they lashed out at Moses. Rather than holding themselves to account for their sinful nature in the desert, they wished for the good old days back in Egypt. Let us keep this in mind as we continue to challenge the oppressors of our time. As things get worse, we must hold ourselves, our leaders, and our oppressors to account. For example, we should not blame all things on Trump, nor should we look to Trump to save our nation. Not that Trump is on the level with Moses, but you get my point. 9. Logic, reason, compromise, nor negotiation will curtail those intent on doing you harm. Pharaoh surrounded himself with wise men, the experts of his time. Of course they were complete hacks. They were not interested in logic and reason, and they were not seeking truth. They were only concerned with staying in the good graces of Pharaoh and retaining their power. These purported wise men scoffed at the signs Moses performed and used trickery to recreate and discredit what Moses was doing. In addition to rolling out con artists, Pharaoh attempts to compromise with Moses. He even repents and agrees to let the Israelites go, but each time, Pharaoh reneges. This pattern, bargain, repent, renege, repeats several times with no change in outcome. By the 10th plague, death of the firstborn, Pharaoh, his officials, and the people of Egypt were like, yeah, you all need to go and go now. In fact, we will pay you to go. Here, take my gold. How about this dish set? You'll probably need one in the desert. Even after effectively funding the Israelites' departure, the Egyptians reneged again and made another attempt to enslave them, cornering the Israelites at the Red Sea. Got it? You can't compromise with evil. You cannot negotiate with those intent on enslaving you. If compromise, negotiation, logic, and reason does not work, what does? And this leads to the 10th lesson. The only way to prevail over a tyrant is to eliminate their source of power. In short order, Egyptian officials were regretting the lost Israelite labor. When Pharaoh thought the Israelites were vulnerable, seemingly trapped by the Red Sea, he planned his attack. And you know the rest of the tale. Moses parts the Red Sea, the Israelites walk to freedom, and Pharaoh's army is swept into the sea. It wasn't until Pharaoh lost his finest chariots, his army, that he finally learns his lesson and never goes after the Israelites again. Just as it was for the Israelites, we will not see the promised land until we comport ourselves properly. Just as it was for the Israelites, our moments of obedience will be followed by backsliding into our old ways. We are getting there, but boy, do we have a long way to go. And know that I fully include myself in this. I have a long way to go. For how long did I ignore my duty to country? For how long did my passivity enable the bad behavior of my elected officials? For how long was I content to conduct myself with integrity within a corrupt system without also working to reveal, much less reform, that system? Far too long. Is all lost? Absolutely not. Remember Moses' message to the Israelites as they face down Pharaoh's army at the Red Sea. Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be still. We the people, go forward in your obedience to God. Keep the faith. God is making our way, and we'll take care of his enemies.
Thank you for joining me. I would love to hear from you. Please submit comments or questions through my website, CarmelaSilaBerti.com, or call me at 302-584-3594. Want to help build the constitutional conservative movement in Chester County and beyond? Then subscribe to my podcast. It's free, and subscriptions help us get the word out. Thanks again.